Hello, I'm Lauren Trevine. I'm a faculty member in computer science here at the University of Minnesota, and I'd like to welcome you all to this talk by Stephen Clift. This is a public lecture organized as part of the university's Conference on Information, Technology, and Everyday Life. This conference is supported by the university president's 21st Century Interdisciplinary Conference Fund, which is committed to exploring the ways in which we can reach across traditional disciplines to better apply technology to everyday challenges, including civic and community life, increasing independence, and lifelong education. We're really happy to have Stephen with us here today. Just to tell you a little bit about him, Steve is an online strategist and he's a public speaker focused on the use of the internet in democracy, governance, and community. He's taken his message all around the world, speaking in countries ranging from Iceland to New Zealand, from Mongolia to Lebanon, and consulting with many governments and organizations, from the United Nations to the UK government, to name just a few. And as some of you heard me mention before, on top of all that, he's the number six Stephen on Google, ahead of Steven Seagal, but below Steven Spielberg. So maybe you can help out by linking to him. So please join me in welcoming Stephen.
Try to imagine this. You're flying at 30,000 feet. You've just crossed northern China, headed into Mongolia, and you've timed it just right to see a never-ending purple sunset. A year ago, when I peered out the window of my plane, I saw beautiful purple nothingness. Mongolia is twice the size of Texas, with fewer than 2 million people. It's moments like these when you do pinch yourself. I thought, how the heck did a Minnesota boy end up being invited to Mongolia to speak about democracy and the internet? Some of my memories began to flood back. My last 10 years I'd spent as a volunteer citizen with eDemocracy.org, which was founded as Minnesota eDemocracy back in 1994. My time leading early e-government for Minnesota from 95 to 97, and the democratic and community spirit in the people I've met in the 24 countries I've managed to get to before visiting Mongolia. As I do on trains, planes, and buses, I grabbed out my yellow notepad. Yes, I use paper. And I scratched down some ideas, and some of these ideas I actually have a chance to share with you today. Everywhere I go, every story I collect adds to the e-democracy mix in my mind. And despite my global networks, the first thing I start thinking about is Minnesota and our local communities. And that's why it's a real honor to be here at home and to have the privilege to share my thoughts with you. After a decade now of experimenting and learning, now is the time for us to build lasting networks for everyday citizens. With our extensive connectivity and broadband that we have here in Minnesota, it's not just time to go to the world online, it's time to come home. Come home as Minnesotans, to be citizens, to strengthen community life online, from the city block that we live on to the county road, our whole neighborhood, our local school, on up to your city, your county, and your state. We're going to start off, we're going to land in Mongolia here in a few minutes. We're going to then open our eyes in Washington, D.C. And then we're going to explore Minnesota as e-democracy interested visitors from the U.K. Now, did you know that e-democracy in Minnesota was actually featured on national television in Japan a couple of years ago? Now, it might be time to list e-democracy next to the Mall of America and Paul Bunyan on our tourist brochures. Well, not quite, of course. But Minnesota has quite a reputation. I'll try to share some of that with you today. And when I landed in Mongolia, before my official duties started, I had a chance to walk to their Red Square. Mongolia is the first place that I've spoken in. It's colder than Minnesota. Their March was like our February. And I walked around and kind of soaked in this former Soviet bloc, sort of Red Square, as I mentioned. And, woke up the next morning, and what did I do? I channel surfed on the television between Russian game shows. Sumo wrestling is huge in Mongolia because the Mongolian wrestlers are beating the Japanese at their own game. But oddly enough, I ran into C-SPAN. I've never seen C-SPAN anywhere outside the United States. And here was Joe Trippi, the webmaster, or not sorry, the campaign manager for the Howard Dean campaign, on my television in Mongolia at the Politics Online conference in Washington, D.C., the conference I missed because I was going to Mongolia. To see the ideas spreading that way, all the way from the United States into the inside of Central Asia and Mongolia, blew me away. It was freaky, to be honest. Well, my week started. I was a guest of the Mongolian Open Society Foundation for a week, and they had me meet with everybody. Mongolia is a new democracy. They don't take it for granted. I mean, they're just less than a decade out of communism. And internet access there is extremely limited. Bandwidth is limited. My house has more bandwidth than to the global internet than all the satellite connections through all the internet service providers in Mongolia combined. The largest internet service provider in Mongolia pays $20,000 a month for the equivalent connection of 5 modems. So with that reality there, it's a different kind of place to be talking about the internet and democracy. Yet there was a great enthusiasm in Mongolia, and I'm going to highlight some of the different meetings I had. I met with NGOs, nonprofit organizations, and here's some of the things that I suggested to them. I said, use the internet to raise your voice, to raise the voice of your constituencies, because you clearly have what I call institutional e-democracy. The government's online, the political parties are online, many of the NGOs are online, the universities are online. A lot of what you have in the most developed democracies in terms of political exchange of information, you have it. It's there. You can build on it. And get ready for a time when more citizens get online. And I encourage the NGOs to advocate for electronic access to government information. If there's anything in paper that you need to do your job now, make sure you ask the government or encourage the government to put it online. Make it accessible. I then went on and I met with the Prime Minister's cabinet staff and the President's staff in 2 different meetings. And my advice to them was this: design an excellent government-wide portal. It'll become the primary interface for citizens. And have a profile democracy section. Don't bury democracy down 7 layers. Make sure that there's a democracy section on your homepage. And be very cautious about how you use that main portal. Don't allow it to be politicized. And that's what the Prime Minister's website is for. Let that site have all the photos and the like. And that's what I did when I ran North Star, Minnesota State Government's homepage. Through 1997, we kept all the pictures of politicians off the homepage. Governor Ventura showed up in 1998, after my time, and his picture showed up on the homepage. If I had been there, I would have fought it. That type of activity should be illegal, at least during election seasons. Now, it's important, though, to note that I said to them, I said, anything you can say on a government-funded microphone is legitimate on the president's website, on the prime minister's website, on the city council member's website. There's a lot of efforts or a lot of resistance to giving our elected officials the tools they need to represent us in governance. So don't be shy, but make sure your online website is not a brochure. And just like the prime minister of Japan, make sure you have a weekly or at least a monthly email newsletter to tell people what's new. Send out a paragraph like the Prime Minister of Japan does. It says, here's what I, a little first person, here's what I think, or here's what I did this week. Make it more intimate with citizens. It's very important to allow citizens to opt in to find out what's new. Now, Mongolia had this site, and I pointed this out to them. I said, you actually are a leader, Mongolia, in online consultation. That's a term you often hear in Canada and Europe. They have a website called open-government.mn. Now, if you type in Clift on Google, you can go to my homepage, and I have links to all of these sites. So you can just go there after the speech and see what I'm talking about. What they do on open-government.mn is share draft legislation in both Mongolian, which I don't read, and English. They take draft legislation. That's their choice, but they put it out there. And think about it. I mean, when do our governments take drafts of legislation and put them online when comments actually matter? So here in Mongolia, we had a great example of e-democracy already. In fact, one of the reasons I left state government in 1997 is it became clear to me that folks in government We're much more interested in helping citizens pay their taxes online, make it easier to pay your taxes, but not really that interested in making it easier for citizens to have a say online about how those taxes are spent. And I went on and I had a meeting with the Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, and I walked into the room and there were all these television cameras and photo, you know, taking pictures, and I had the meeting. It must have been like going back in time because we're on this big table and we had almost like a Soviet-style negotiation. And they said, well, what networks can we join? And I said, you can join this email list that I have on parliaments. The next day I find out that I was on national television, two networks, and that they did a press release announcing that Mongolia had entered this agreement with the Democracies Online to join these networks. Not too often you get a press release from inviting someone to join an email list. Then I went on to meet with the parliamentary staff. I think it was about all of them. They're all in this big room. And here was my advice to the staff in Parliament. I said, make as much of your public process available online as possible. And you know what? Minnesota is actually a model for that. This is a weird story that the Mongolians thought this was quite odd, actually. But our House and our Senate use Mongolian domain names. If you go to house.mn or senate.mn, those will take you to the Minnesota legislative sites. Now, there is no question that the Minnesota is actually a leader in this area. And one of the things that a lot of people don't know about is we actually have access in our chamber. So when the members are debating, when they're on television and debating on the floor, you know, you can send them an email. And if their laptop is turned on and they decide to open up their email, they can see what you have to say. That's something which is almost unheard of in the rest of the world. It's important to invest in your representative processes online. I said, don't spend all your e-government money on the executive branch. If you enable the agencies without investing in representative processes, you're going to lose power. So you have to invest a portion of your e-government money on your democracy processes, or they will fade away, at least from the online experience. Now, after the speech, we went into a side room, and I got a virtual tour. This is what happens when I travel. People give me tours of websites in different languages. I've been looking all over the world for a parliament that actually has figured out how to deal with all this incoming email, how to sort out the spam from the mail for constituents, how to create the tools so that members of the legislature or Congress can actually respond to people. And here in Mongolia, they'd created an enterprise-wide web-based system. Excellent. A model that maybe we could use here in Minnesota for the governor, for city council members, for our legislatures. And that's a real challenge. It is email. How do you respond to it? I often say if there's a will, there's a way. And I am noticing that some elected officials are actually turning off their email, or at least they take the email off the website, and they put up a web form. I honestly believe if an elected official is too afraid to list their email publicly, they're acting anti-democratically. They're taking away the tool that citizens love most, which is email, the ability to have a copy of what you send. And instead, they're putting up web forms where you don't get a copy of what you sent and have no proof that you tried to contact government. Now, I see this again and again in the United States. I had a final major presentation to citizens and students. I said, you know what? Be an e-citizen. You can create and not just consume information. You can help create a demand for access to government online. Let the government know what you want online, that you want more of it. And you know what that'll do? That'll help empower the civil servant that has some of the same democratic passions that you do. There are people in government who want to open up online. They need to hear from you in order to make that happen. I also asked the folks in the room if they're under 25 to raise their hand. And two-thirds of the room was. And I said, you know, when I was 25, I helped start Minnesota e-democracy, sort of a fluke, an accident. I thought, well, it'd be fun to put some candidate information on the World Wide Web. It'd be fun to get some citizens together to host an online discussion. And I've learned from that anyone, any of you, can help define the future by using these tools from your living room, from your work site, you name it. You can make a difference with these tools. Everything that I just said about Mongolia applies to Minnesota as a whole. It also applies to our local communities. You can't have everyday citizens or community life in a vacuum. An essential foundation for everyday citizenship is open and accessible in a fundamentally online government. Well, back in 1994, when the citizen volunteers with eDemocracy.org created that world first election website here in Minnesota, media from around the world put us on a pedestal. They'd ask, is this the end of politics as we know it? One journalist commented, and I replied, no, this is an experiment. Well, after a decade, I can confidently say the experiment is over. We actually now know enough where we can do this for real. A lot of folks thought they were doing it for real in the dot-com boom, but they weren't, all right? There's a lot that we now know that we can do for real. The problem is that in the last few years, a lot of my optimism has been replaced by concern from what I'm seeing on the horizon. So let's open our eyes in Washington, D.C. Last month, I had the privilege of speaking at the Politics Online Conference, that same conference I watched on television from Mongolia last year. I was there this year. It attracts a lot of online campaigners, the folks that work for candidates with the Internet, folks that do online advocacy. And the conference host was reflecting on the 2004 election and how the political establishment finally woke up to the power of the Internet. She said, "We won." Well, what did they win? We proved that we can raise money online, that we can fire up our activists, and we can generate lots of heat. And I mumbled to the person next to me. I said, "Politics as usual won." That's what's happened with e-politics or e-democracy in traditional politics, is they figured out they can raise money and they can make a lot of noise. And I have a tremendous concern about that. Now, one of the biggest buzzes, in fact, at this conference was not about political blogs. I mean, you heard a lot about political blogging this cycle, but, you know, those online diaries, for those who aren't as familiar with them, you know, in politics, they're actually quite overhyped, while other types of blogs are actually underappreciated, in my opinion. But the biggest buzz that I picked up on was a thing called email acquisition. Well, that's a trade term, I believe. How many of you are ready to be acquired so you can help feed the beast? So you can feed the beast of the so-called influence industry. Well, here's how it works. It's not about spam. It's about opt-in email. It's about putting up an online petition, a tell-a-friend. You know, basically every candidate, every political interest group, they want your email address because they know that's how they can create a relationship with you and ask you for money. And what do they do with the money? They spend it on old-fashioned campaigning. I mean, the majority of Kerry's money that he raised in the primary phase was actually online. Now, I was incredibly worried, actually, that this cycle was going to destroy the reputation for the Internet and politics and democracy, that we would have a virtual civil war. I had predicted this, and I was completely wrong. What happened was the candidates raised the money, which is good. It's good to have small donations. That's a good thing generally. But they just spent it all on crap on television, on junk on television. You know, they kept the bad advertising, you know, out there, and haven't really sort of used these resources to really add much value. Now the election is over, and what do we see? We see partisan vitriol from all sides continue. I had a conference speaker to my right from a group called Right March. They're a conservative alternative to MoveOn.org, and they suggested red meat works. In fact, I have some examples here from the judicial court battles in the Senate. There's a number of nominees which the Democrats are holding up, about 10 of them, I believe. This is from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Each one of them, of course, is a right-wing activist with legal and political views three steps to the right of Attila the Hun. If you're as outraged as we are, see the word outrage over and over again. Right March on their website, on the other side, "Stop, Move On and the liberal senators from judicial tyranny." The far leftists at MoveOn.org are at it again. My vision of everyday citizens online is not about allowing the Internet to be captured by the extremes or even the political class. I mean, I could imagine that secret meeting between the digital arms traders, you know, on the right and the left. Hey, let's fan the flames of political hatred online for our mutual benefit. The more conflict, the more money we can raise. That's how online advocacy is evolving now. We rile people up, we generate unanswered emails to elected officials, and then we wonder why no one's listening, And that kind of e-politics will work its way from D.C. to Minnesota, right down into our communities, if we do not offer places online that build actually from the mainstream, that build from the common interest. If we don't bring people together who have different perspectives online, we're going to get what's emerging in Washington. Luckily, we have examples here and beyond that we can spread and deepen across Minnesota. I'd like to tell another story about some visitors from the UK. Last summer, I had three guests from the UK government come to town with the local eDemocracy National Project. They came from Minnesota for a little eDemocracy tour. I showed them the Minnesota legislature. We sat in the house and saw how they do webcasting. I showed them, they showed us, how their processes are online. We went down to Northfield, where we saw this community blogging effort where community news and photographs and local bloggers, many of them city officials, and online calendars have pulled together a model, a true national model for local community online. And then we had them meet folks involved with issues forums. eDemocracy.org's model for local citizen-to-citizen email forums that have real agenda-setting power. Well, I'll talk more about each of those examples in a minute, but when they were about to leave, they surprised me. We were having coffee, and they said, you know what? Enhanced webcasting of public meetings. We want some of that. Issues forums. Yeah, a couple of those. Blogs for public officials. We want them too. And we have funding. We have funding. Words I've never heard. On April 1st this year, I emerged from my digital hole of a home office and with the help of a few dozen small and some larger subcontractors, completed projects in those three areas and a fourth project on case studies. So I'm going to share some of the highlights of our tour as well as mix in some of the things that we produced. So our UK guests, we drove into Northfield on a brilliant day, mixed in with some nice thunder showers. It was crazy days. So all the con was out in downtown there with their tables and their sails. And we met folks at the Contented Cow. It's Northfield's English neighborhood pub. And I had shepherd's pie, actually. A number of the folks from the UK had been there for 2 weeks, and so they actually quite enjoyed the fact that they could have some food from home. Now, Northfield Citizens Online has a community weblog. And one side of the page is like basically community news. It's not, you know, opinionated news. It's pretty much sort of what's going on at the different meetings. Lots of photos. If a street's been closed, like I'll take a picture of the sign that says closed road. very accessible, very interesting. And on the right-hand column, they actually have all the headlines from local bloggers. A county commissioner blogs, the police chief blogs, lots of different people in the community are contributing to this event online. And it's a lot different than these national blogs, these national political blogs, where a lot of them come across like television pundit wannabes. You know, they're shouting from their soapbox, but there's very little dialogue. And the UK, actually, with Griff's help, Griff Wigley, who helped with the tour, actually brought over some of those resources and ideas to create blogs locally. And Scott Neal and Griff went over and did a blogging tour of the UK to talk about how the city manager of Eden Prairie, who lives in Northfield, there's a connection there, has a blog. And it's a great story that we can all learn from across Minnesota. Now, they also have a community calendar using syndication. RSS. I have it really stupid, Steve. Don't use technical jargon. But I want to say that term. If you've ever been to a website and seen a little button that says XML, a little orange button, okay, they're all over the place. Nobody explains it, but they mean something. And I want to say that they're really important because they allow anyone who has a website to share what's new with others. And people can aggregate that information. The problem right now online is there's so much information. If you're trying to find something, it's a needle in a haystack. With RSS, basically, you can create like 5 or 10 daggers, and you can stick them toward the top of the haystack. Still got to dig around a little bit, but for lots of stuff, it becomes quite accessible. Very important. So in Minneapolis, how might we use RSS? Well, you'd get the city council, the school board, the park board, the library board, etc., to share what's new in a feed. They could syndicate that content. Even public meeting announcements could become more available. So instead of having to go to 10 websites to find out what's going on today or what's going on this week, you could go to one website. We need our public institutions to do things like we're seeing in Northfield all across Minnesota with RSS. I promise no more jargon. With webcasting, we also found out that what the House does in Minnesota is really hard to replicate because they have a database, a very sophisticated system. They enhance the meeting. So if you play the webcast, you can actually get the draft amendments and actually the amendments as they're proposed, the legislation, fiscal notes, all kinds of information. But in local government, they tend not to have those databases of meeting documents. So we actually kind of need to build something like that. And so one of the lessons I would say for Minnesota is we actually need a statewide online system for announcing all public meetings at all levels, just like Rhode Island does. They did it. We can do it too. But we can take it a step further. We can include agendas and handouts and webcasts. And so what we built for the UK was a system that allowed us to take a very small meeting, like at a parish council, which is like our townships, and make that available online. Along the lines also, I actually brought a prop here. The Blue Book. How many of you have heard of the Blue Book? Well, that's what you get from the Secretary of State every couple of years. Comes out, and by the time you receive it in the mail, it's often out of date. Maybe county commissioners had new elections, and the legislators, actually a lot of them are up to date. But what we need online is a virtual version of this, and not just legislators, but every single elected official from the township to the school board, to local cities, need to be in an up-to-date directory where a citizen can go and put in their zip code and find out who represents them from an authoritative source. So we can put this Blue Book online. And I have to diverge a little further. I couldn't figure out quite where to fit this in my speech. The rule of law. Nothing that I have seen with the internet and democracy necessitates its use when it comes to sharing power or opening up democracy. If we want, as citizens, want government to do more than just the basics online, we need it to be put into law. So you heard it here first. It's time to mandate e-democracy. To me, the alternative is to write off real representative and participatory democracy in the information age, because nothing voluntary, none of the best examples will become widespread, in my opinion. Now, an example is Poland. So with their freedom of information law, they didn't just say, information should be accessible. The law actually says local governments must disseminate online spending information, not just the proposed budgets, but actually their spending reports. That's what I mean by the rule of law. The things that we want to see online, we need to put it into law. Now, another idea might be an online notification, or I call e-notification. Now, St. Paul actually does this today, where they have a tool they use from GovDocs, and you can go in there, and you can actually decide what documents you want to have sent to you. Now, at a minimum, that type of service should be funded at all levels of government because real accessibility comes with timely notification. It's no good for citizens if you don't know about the information when it actually mattered. If you get it after the meeting, it's too late, so notification is key. Let me go back to webcasting. I have a few more comments about that. So we created a site called democaster.org for the UK government. We had a local company, MentorMate. They're here and actually in Bulgaria. And we worked together to make this open source set of tools to allow simple audio to be put on the web with webcam images. Really simple. So it's like for the small meetings, like I mentioned. And the idea is not that you're going to have thousands of people show up to a township board meeting because you webcast it. It's that you had 10 people in the room and another 10 people, double the numbers, watched it or listened to it online. If you bring the cost down low enough, we can make meetings more accessible for those who are interested. And that's key. Another idea, some future funding perhaps, will take a speakerphone and make it so that any speakerphone can collect audio from any meeting. So that task force of a task force of a task force, there'll never be a video camera there, but if you wanted to record it, punch in a number, and at least it'll be recorded for the three members who missed the meeting. And you can integrate that. We can build those types of tools. It's incredibly important that we begin to complement what I call time and place discriminatory forms of representative democracy. We have to accept that the quaint Norman Rockwell image of a town hall meeting is smashing up against the reality of our busy lives, where most things that we experience are available to us when our schedules allow. If democracy, if representative democracy is not available at anywhere at any time, then it's not going to survive the information age. Not to replace traditional forms, we will still meet in person, but we must fundamentally rethink how we allow people to participate and make sure they can do it when they have time, after they put the kids to bed. If they're disabled, if they can't make it to a meeting, they can actually still participate in a real way. The last part of the tour with our guests from the UK was issues forums. Now we met with a number of participants in St. Paul and in Minneapolis and the forum managers. And what happened was in 1994, we had this election website that I mentioned. Well, something happened on our Minnesota politics, our statewide email forum. When election was over, people kept talking. We discovered by accident what I call the holy grail of the so-called failed.com era. We actually found an online method where participants themselves generate the content. So as a host, your job is to guide it and make sure it doesn't blow up. That's incredibly important, to be able to do things at a sort of a low cost or a reasonable effort and have value be generated online. And I was on a forum, on a panel in 1994 when everyone was wide-eyed about this internet, and I'm going to give you the exact same story when I explain how this works. Fax machines, right? Email was brand new back then. So imagine you got a fax machine. If you wanted to send a fax to 1,000 people, send it through 1,000 times, be there for a few days, but you know, you could get it out there and assume that they have a fax machine on the other end. Well, what an email list is it gives you the ability to send one, put the fax through once, push send, and have it instantly go to 1,000 people. But not only that, no long distance charges. It can be anywhere in the world or anywhere in the town. And anyone who received that fax can push send and not only send a reply to you, but a reply to the other 1,000 people that received that fax. We often take for granted the power of the ability to send one simple email to hundreds of citizens. And that's what we have with these issues forums. Now, in 1998, we went local. First in Minneapolis, then in St. Paul, then in Winona, actually, in 2001. We even have a startup forum in Chicago. Some folks from Minneapolis moved down there, and they said, where is our issues forum? And we've helped them get one started. Now, if you want to join any of these forums in these cities, just go to Google, type in e-democracy, e-democracy. That's all you need, and you'll find us. Now, one of the key lessons about these forums is they're built in the common interest. You know, edemocracy.org does not have an agenda. It's not right or left. It's a place that tries to bring people together from across the political spectrum, very rare online. And we facilitate these forums. So David Brower, he's a neighborhood journalist in Minneapolis, is our editor editor. He's our facilitator of these forums. Very important to have that role. And I want to bring these to life a little bit. So in Minneapolis right now, what are they talking about? Well, they're talking about the election for mayor and council seats. They're having a discussion about the city's wireless internet plan. They're discussing the park board. In St. Paul, what are they talking about? They're talking about booster clubs in the schools, recreation centers, and just last week they had a discussion about helicopters along the river, buzzed a few people's homes, and what ends up the next day in the Pioneer, a couple days later in the Pioneer Press, and they cite the forum. In fact, one thing we find with these forums is they're much more likely to be cited in the media than they are to, say, you know, affect a decision maker, even though all the council members, as far as we can tell, are either directly subscribed or have a staff person who monitor the forum. In Winona, we're talking about the county board, about school board salaries, about proposed tax increment financing districts. I mean, real exciting stuff, right? Local issues. Maybe tax increment financing is not for everyone, but these are folks, these are active citizens who are showing up and getting involved and having a discussion about local issues. And let's not forget the UK. We actually opened two local issues forums in the UK recently. And in Brighton, some of the topics include graffiti, park and ride, recycling, a very exciting discussion about the quality of school lunches, and, well, we've heard this here, stadiums. So now if you're thinking, what about my city, you're dead on. You know, what about your community? Do your fellow citizens expect that they should be able to post their views online and actually have them read by the mayor? Across Minnesota, most places don't have these types of forums. Well, they should. Citizens should expect that. You know, and together we can build many more of these online spaces across Minnesota, in the UK, anywhere in the world. This is a place where we can have a say, where we can influence those with power, exchange ideas, our passions, and learn from one another. Tim Erickson, he's the longtime forum manager of the St. Paul Issues Forum. He actually helped us produce a 60-page guide on how to start an issues forum. So go to our website and download it if you'd like to help build a forum. Well, one more technical note. In New Zealand, I discovered a tool called GroupServer. It combines email lists and web forums and that RSS stuff I mentioned earlier. I sent some money from the UK government down to New Zealand, and they finished off a tool that they released open source. Now, open source means that any of the advanced techies, not me, can install it for free, can play with it, can improve it. And this new tool will allow us to extend and expand and involve many more people in Minnesota and beyond. So what's next? What are some of the things that we might do here in Minneapolis, across the river in St. Paul, and in communities across the state? Well, right now we have about 900 people on the Issues Forum in Minneapolis. These are what I call everyday participants. And how do we reach more people? How do we reach 1% of the population? That's 4,000 people. How do you reach 10% of the population? How do we create more spaces that attract more people so that they can be part of this network? Well, there are already some neighborhood networks online in this community. One of the models is Cleveland Park in Washington, D.C. They have over 2,300 people on a neighborhood network, not just talking about issues, but trading couch for sale, lots of things about being a neighbor. So we need neighborhoods across our communities, neighborhood forums, excuse me. We also need to think about community priorities. It's not good enough just to talk about issues. Maybe you want to solve some problems, right? Well, there are priorities in our cities: housing, drug violence, parks, graffiti, litter. Well, there's a project called Community Builders New South Wales in Australia, where they're actually using the tools to communicate to actually implement public programs. So for whatever priority there is in the city, we can use these same tools to connect the people who are trying to solve that problem. So if you're working on graffiti, we can get the 100 people who care most about that in Minneapolis or in St. Paul together to trade information to complement those in-person meetings. That's what I mentioned that before. If you miss a meeting, you should be able to use these online tools to stay in tune. So when you make to the next meeting, you're not going to be totally out of the loop, or that you actually have a reason to stay involved. These online tools can help with that. We need to build ways to connect citizens across these forums. So let's just say this is kind of like Rotary, right? We have service clubs, and citizens come together, build these forums. We have 100. We have 1,000. Who knows? 10 years from now, 20 years from now, how many we'll have? We need to have a question and answer network that allows citizens who care about a certain issue. Let's just say it's recycling. Check a little box. I care about recycling. That someone from any city could post a note to everyone else who cares about recycling to get advice, to allow the knowledge that's built into our communities to be exchanged among our cities. We can do those types of things with emerging technology. I have one more word here, wiki, all right? There's a site called Wikipedia. It is now probably the world's most read encyclopedia. And wiki is very simple. It just means you can edit this page. You can go to the page, you can push edit, and you can change it. Anyone can change it. Sometimes people mess them up. Often people add value. I would like to see us use wikis to create nonpartisan voter guides here in Minneapolis and in St. Paul. Figure out how we can also add value to a site called myballot.net, which is one of the sites here in Minnesota where you can type in your address and find out who's on your ballot. We need to make sure that people can see all the way down the ballot in our local elections that are coming up in 2005. And I'd also like to see a new feature on notification. You need to take these interactive spaces. I mean, a lot of people don't have time to follow these every day. I mean, they might pop into the website once in a while. But we need to make it easy for Governor Pawlenty or Mayor Ryback or any elected official to be notified anytime a keyword, and the first word they'll put in will be their name, is mentioned on any of our forums. We need to make sure that there are ways that people can access these forums based on the issues that interest them most or whether they're talked about. Well, I've learned that local online activity must be authentically local. You don't want to create virtual ghost towns. You don't want to give the impression that an online place exists unless it really does. So a lot of the things that happened in the dot-com era, they had all these websites that looked great, they raised their expectations, but for the most part, they were virtual ghost towns. You want to avoid that. I've also found that many of the leading tools, blogs, web forums, email lists, online calendars, they're all cobbled together. There is no one grand, one-size-fits-all solution. They tend to die. I also have found that every day there are more everyday citizens than the day before. And we found, though, through eDemocracy, that people actually find out about these types of forums, these experiences, through word of mouth, online and often more so offline. And we need to really figure out how to make it easier to navigate our local communities online, to make it so that immigrants and youth and other people will have a chance to stumble into this stuff and not just be told because they happen to know someone who's in the know. Very important. I've also found that two-way is transformative. A lot of this content on our government websites, our media websites, to be honest, it's not all that engaging. It's often very one-way. So if you want to do something in your neighborhood, as a volunteer, do something interactive. A lot of the content work can be very resource-intensive, and so build off of your own activity, but don't start with all kinds of content, unless you have lots of spare time or you can pay somebody to do it. Well, I want to conclude by sharing off a handful of final lessons. I sent a query locally and around the world, trying to get people to tell us what's going on with the internet in their communities. And so here's some bookmarks for you. I mentioned Cleveland Park in D.C. Well, in South Como neighborhood in St. Paul, they invite people to join their forum at National Night Out. So at National Night Out this year, if you're there, collect everybody's email address, create a block club email list, or create a neighborhood email list. You can do it. They share advice on home repair services. They even organize babysitting exchanges. There's a virtual block club on Pleasant Avenue in Minneapolis. They actually have their own email list for their block, and it came in very handy the other day when they dealt with a rash of thefts from their mailboxes. They used the forum to figure out what was going on. And speaking of fighting crime, Luther Kruger, he's a civilian in the police department. He understands two-way online communication. The first precinct, downtown precinct, they actually have email lists with security guards, bar owners, apartment owners, and they have this network. It's kind of like a neighborhood watch on steroids, right? Okay, so in seconds, the police department or even a local security officer in a building can pass out a photo, an email photo, of a robbery suspect, and this has led to successful arrests. And now one of the recent advancements is they have this email list of bar owners, and so when someone's arrested, they actually figure out what bar were they at? Where did they get drunk? Because that's a lot of folks that are arrested downtown are folks that were overserved. And so they pass this out to all the bars via email. And so that kind of brings up a sense of accountability. You get a sense about where they're not training their people to cut people off. Now, one of the challenges is that we can't really choose our own government or community portal, right? Because we live in a certain place. But if I could choose, my national portal would be Canada. My state portal would be Washington State. I live in Seoul, South Korea for my city. And you know what? East Nokomis here in Minneapolis would be my neighborhood. Those are some of the best sites in the world that I've seen at those different levels. Now, my wife, Laurel, she loves the Standish Erickson email newsletter. I live one neighborhood to the north. But you know what? East Nokomis is a model for what local content can look like on a neighborhood website. One of the problems is that governments have a monopoly position. They don't really have any competition, for people who are providing that content. But they need to appreciate that governments are still competing for citizens, for our eyeballs. And if we just spend all our time shopping online or being entertained online and have little utility by going to government website, government's losing out. One last set of emails that came in to me from my query were about schools and local parent networks. Now, in Minneapolis, take a look at the blog network with Barton Open School. They got blogs all across the school. Or in Berkeley, California, check out the Parents Network. And in Brooklyn, New York, the Park Slope Parents, they have a neighborhood forum. And these types of parent forums and school forums, they're a great example of where citizens are being many-to-many and communicating about very local things. So to conclude, I have a message, okay? You can be an everyday citizen. You can be an e-citizen online. There's a recipe for that. It's motivation, content, and places. We need to bring together those who are motivated to make our communities a better place, to participate in democracy between elections. We need active citizens, active content consumers and producers on blogs, forums. We need webcasters. We need digital photographers, people who take a community focus. We need content. We need our governments, our community and educational institutions. We need the media to do their part to make their rich content available online. They need to put it in convenient formats, in a timely way, and they need to personalize it so we can find out what's new. What do I care about? And have it be sent to you. And finally, third, we need places. We need places online that capture the sparks of community interest, places that foster two-way communication among all citizens from the very local level on up. With this recipe, we can leverage the content from democratic institutions. We can break the exclusive stranglehold of time and place discrimination on our representative processes. And it is rare to see this recipe come together on its own. But we've scoured around. We've looked at different countries, looked at places around here. And you know what I see today really excites me. Yes, I'm concerned about what's happening in D.C. with e-politics, but what I see happening locally here gives me optimism again. And I don't know about you, but I'm ready to build a decade for the everyday citizen. There'll be no instant successes, but with determination, desire, and a democratic intent, we can achieve incremental success. We can build real and lasting momentum, and we will meet a generational challenge to save democracy in the information age from politics as usual, by building real community life online.
Time for questions, and as I said, a balance.
Good question. The question was, how does a government website balance between what citizens want or need and what the government wants to tell them? It's a very difficult challenge for governments because there's political issues. I mean, you got a mayor, right? You got to make sure that the mayor's priorities are put on the homepage. You put up a photo, you know, because you have these pressures within the bureaucracy to sort of do that. One of the techniques that I encourage governments to think about is what I call democratized navigation. They need to create places on the website where, based on how citizens use the website, links are created. When you go to download.com, you can click on a piece of software, a kind of software, and say, what's the most popular? And you can decide what's most popular is probably good enough for you. And so government needs to integrate those types of features so that whether it's recycling day or whatever, snow emergencies, for example, I mean, those tend to be on the homepage, but if it's not, information about it, you need to make sure what the clicking behavior results in an easier way to navigate the website. In the next 3 hours, I'll say, no. Good question. The question is, how do you maintain or build civility in online forums? Are the forums that, you know, eDemocracy hosts different than other forums that we see online? What we've learned, and to be honest, what I often say is that, you know, 99% of political discussion on the internet is pure junk, and ours is half junk, all right? The miracle is that half has value. By requiring people, in our case, to sign their real names, to focus on local issues, which are much less partisan or ideological, we have, I think, an increased level of civility. On our statewide forum, I think it is much more partisan than our local forums, and it's just the nature of the beast. You know, the higher up, the more nationalized you go in your discussions, the more partisan the rhetoric. The key thing that we find is that you have to have a facilitator and some rules. And the facilitator plays an important role because behind the scenes or even publicly, they can help guide the discussion. They can tell someone, you know what, you can't call people names. I mean, you'd think that'd be obvious, but people like to call people names, you know, shoot the messenger, right? So you get some of that. And so we often deal a lot with just trying to remind people they're actually talking to other citizens, other real people, not just computers. They're talking to people. And that helps considerably. And it's also that idea that it's not just a discussion for the sake of discussion. We actually have integrated these forums into local community life. I mean, the local journalists follow it for story ideas. You know, in Minneapolis, when R.T. Rabach announced that he was going to run for mayor in 2001, he actually announced that he was running on the forum before he did in person at the press conference. When I explain it to other people in other parts of the country or the world, they're like, what? You know, a politician that posts on an online open forum? I mean, how could it be? And in Brighton, when we applied our model in the U.K., we actually had, like, the second day, we had two or three local councillors that already started to post. And they post from time to time, and that's really important. And that helps raise, I think, the value of the discussion. So the question, in Mongolia, they have opengovernment.mn, and they put out draft legislation. You know, how do you manage, or how do they manage the input? how does any government manage, really, at a larger level, lots of questions, lots of emails? How do they make that work? The governments that have figured out this online consultation or this online public hearing thing are the ones that create structure. They basically say, okay, here's a document to read. Like in Queensland in Australia, it's great. They actually break the document up into sections, and they say, if you've read this section, now you can answer these five questions. And they're very smart about asking questions that they need the answers to. And the more, multiple choice and the more sort of data that can be generated, not just open-ended questions, which are still important, but the more data that can be generated, at least when they add it all up, decision makers will be able to have a summary. Because one of the most important things about these types of online consultation is actually to end up with something that somebody will actually read that's thinking about, well, should we go left or right with this issue? Email remains a real challenge for elected officials, as I mentioned before, and it will continue to be sort of a general thing. But I would say that most elected officials, as well as these consultations, they should put up sort of online surveys in structured places where they can gather more data so they can actually ease their responses and make it more efficient to respond electronically than, say, dealing with a paper letter, which tends to be dealt with more seriously today. Yes? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Question from a representative of the Citizens League. It was about their website and how they're using their blog and thinking about forums and how you actually use these tools to sort of build civic capacity. And I think that's dead on with the issue of networks on community priorities. I think envisioned statewide, a number of key issues. And in The Democracy, we actually experimented with what we called session topics. We created a forum on education, on transportation. And we tried to say that those who cared most about those issues could trade policy knowledge. And what we found was that unless we engaged a graduate student or someone from the legislature, someone from the agency to actually feed that type of space, it was sort of just out there. So I think if you want to build community capacity with these tools to improve the policymaking process, and if you want to do it from sort of the community as a whole, not just government out, you need to create partnerships and collaborations. Figure out how to engage the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota, how to engage universities in the greater Minnesota, how to engage the Citizens League and eDemocracy and the Department of Administration, you name it. Figure out how we can bring some people around the table to say, you know what, if we all link to a knowledge exchange on policy issues that's actually interactive, we might actually then drive enough traffic there to have it work. Because one of the challenges is with a lot of websites, people just don't come back or they forget that it's there, and it's very difficult to build critical mass. And that's one of the things we've also learned from our own opening forum when we opened forums. In Brighton, in the UK, we said, you know what, you cannot open your forum until you have 100 people. We force the recruitment up front so that when it opens, it's a place. And a lot of sites that have created new features, they put it up and then they basically say, okay, come on in. And every citizen who's coming into that site basically says, there's nobody here. And it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. You got to actually have an egg in this case. Yes?
Can you talk about the...
Okay. Question is about, who's showing up. 20 years ago, were these the people who were showing up at the town hall meeting and the internet maybe perhaps brings them back? Or is it the people who are showing up in person are still just showing up online and maybe the average citizen might not be tuning in? In our surveys of our forum participants, we ask people, are you an activist citizen or an average citizen? I mean, they're self-described. I think about 40% said they're activists and 30% said they were average. And so what we do tend to find online is that the first folks that do show up online are those who are showing up in person. It's a compliment to them. They're passionate. They're going for it. But what the internet is really good at, I believe, is what I call capturing the sparks of political interest. So what typically would happen in the offline world is that someone might sign a paper petition. They might go to a rally, right? They sign a petition, and they never hear anything. Now if you go to an online advocacy site, sign a petition, you get an email once a week. That group starts educating you and informing you. If something happened, you decided to join one of our forums because of a very local issue that, you're sort of a one issue every 10-year kind of person, suddenly you're stuck on this forum and you got to decide to leave, but then you're like, huh, I didn't know that my opinions could actually get that much play, that I could actually express myself and I think I'm as well-spoken or well-written as anybody else here, so I'll just stick around. And so the net does a really good job of capturing sparks. The open question, one of these challenges for the next decade, is can you create sparks online? Whether it's, you know, through interactive websites geared toward youth that use flash animation that explain how the city works, can you do something online that really fires somebody up, that has that emotional experience that they get from being in person or seeing something on television? And, you know, you're seeing there are a few examples, but for the most part, that remains an open challenge with the net. Griff, in the back. The question is about sort of the lack of media examples from, you know, very local community media on up to larger media organizations. About 5 years ago, the media began, fairly large papers online, began experimenting with online forums. About two-thirds of those forums have actually been turned off because they didn't generate revenue. The ones that have kept open are often at the papers where they see value in that. It's sort of part of their mission. It just isn't something that generates enough eyeballs or enough, you know, data that allows them to generate revenue. At the community side, even when you get down to sort of local neighborhood newspapers, a lot of them just haven't invested in their online presence. Some have, but typically if you come from a media world, you still have very much a broadcast mentality. The internet is fundamentally interactive. Now, what governments do, media does, interest groups, I mean, a lot of it's very one way, and that's why they have a hard time connecting with people, to be honest. What I have seen, at least some examples of where, like Minnesota Public Radio or the Star Tribune, they both have forums. And with eDemocracy, in some ways, our statewide forums aren't as much our emphasis because these larger organizations have the ability to generate more eyeballs. You know, and so we've sort of started focusing even more and more local, and that's one reason I bring up a lot of local examples, which tend to be non-commercial or voluntary-based. And I know also there are some quasi-media efforts to try to create some of these sort of toolkits for e-neighborhoods and things, and I think a lot of them won't go very far because they're trying to take on the whole country, and they'll end up not having enough bodies. So, you know, if you're interested in these spaces happening, you know, we need to get foundations interested. Local governments need to get interested. I mean, any local government, for example, or a Kiwanis Club, or, you know, anybody that's charitable gambling in the state, right? If you're funding, you know, a little swing set at the park, you know, for $10,000, you could have a community issues forum, and you could, you know, have a little stipend for a few volunteers, pay for some pizzas, and you're ready to go. And so we need to think about how we begin to raise some of the resources to create more of these interactive spaces, but do it in a way that's friendly to the local media. Ways that either allows them to, you know, syndicate where they can put the forums on their site just as, you know, put their branding on it just as it's on your own community site, or ways to sort of create those positive linkages so that the eyeballs in the community can find their way around. The question is about critical mass. What if you have too much? What if there's too many messages, too much volume, too much news? How do you get someone to come back or wade through that? It's the needle in the haystack. Basically, the haystack's getting bigger and bigger, and sometimes it's covering you up. And tools like RSS, which I mentioned, allow you to get headlines from multiple websites, and you kind of create your own little window. My Yahoo is an example. You can grab these little orange XML buttons, right? And you can gather the six sites that you like, and then when you go to your My Yahoo page, you can see sort of what's happening. And that's a really useful tool to sort of kind of pique your interest to get you back without sending you, like, all the text. That's helpful. What we do on our own forums with eDemocracy.org is we tell people they can't post more than twice a day. That's a very important rule, because one of the problems with online forums is when two or three people go back and forth and drive the rest of us crazy. And you see that in a lot of spaces online. And you know, freedom's great, right? You know, but rules are also good if you want to try to kind of craft a discussion so that more people can be involved. It's sort of like a virtual talking stick. You know, when you got the stick, you can talk. And I think we need to see more experiments like that where people come to realize that, you know, having more participants rather than more posts from fewer people is a value we need to embrace. So their work online. It may be an issue of terminology, but you tend to find information online like votesmart.com. Sorry, votesmart.org, Project VoteSmart. You can get ratings that interest groups do of elected officials, and they're rating them based on their voting record. So that's one kind of rating that you get, which is more for politicians. When it comes to like the individual work of an individual civil servant, I'm not aware of anything quite like that in the United States. Where I would look would be a place like South Korea, where it's very much an accountability society. When you get to the airport, you go into the restroom. They actually have the photograph of the person who's in charge of keeping that bathroom clean. Right? And so they do a lot of things online similar to that, where if someone has a crime record or something, you know, you can actually look it up. And it's much more accessible. Well, you can do some crime record stuff here, too, but it's much more accessible as far as I know. And they also do a lot with a system called Open System in South Korea, where in Seoul, where you can find out which civil servant has your form on their desk. And that way, if you know and the mayor can know and anyone can know, they can't force a bribe out of you. And that's not say, public evaluating their work, but it's creating that accountability, which I think is a pretty interesting concept. All right. Well, I really want to thank you for coming out to hear about everyday citizens and community life in the information age. Thank you.